I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Chiara Cordelli, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. We're discussing her 2020 book, The Privatized State, Princeton University Press. Her main areas of research are social and political philosophy, with a particular focus on theories of distributive justice and political legitimacy, and she has published on these topics in major journals such as the APSR. Okay, well, first of all, Chiara Cordelli, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
Chiara, I love the book. It was a great philosophical discussion and critical analysis of the, what you call the privatized state in America and elsewhere. I appreciated learning a lot about this topic and about your rigor and persuasiveness in your arguments. I was hoping that you could start by just giving us a sense of what your motivation was for writing the book and why you took up this particular topic.
Absolutely. So I guess when I started writing the book, I had two sort of animating goals in mind. So first, I wanted to provide a sort of normative analysis, a diagnosis and critique of what I see as a truly important transformation of the mode of governing and of the administrative state itself in contemporary liberal democracies. And so, as I say at the beginning of the book, if the 20th century was the age of the bureaucratization of the mother state with its expanded class of ministers and public officials, a mother state that has been central to political theory also in its, the 20th century instead can be regarded as age of its increasing privatization. And I think actually political theory instead hasn't fully grappled with this transformation. So that was my first goal. And then I wanted to build on this sort of normative analysis to construct a more positive and ideal view of what a legitimate system of public administration should look like. And I think this were worthy goal, not only because I think it's fair to say that political theory has fairly neglected the practice of governing a public administration in recent years, but also because answering this question required going back to very fundamental philosophical questions, including the nature of the public and private distinction, the nature of representation, the foundation of democratic authority, and so on and so forth. So I thought those were, you know, it's always good to go back to the to the foundations.
Yeah, and I love that. I love that ambition in this book also. So that was great. Yeah. So can you just start just with the basics in the sense of, you know, the very idea of what you call the privatized state? If you could give us a sense of what you mean by that, and some examples of the privatization of state activities, just to sort of orient us.
Sure. So the private state is a state generally where government functions and responsibility are systematically outsourced to private actors. So, for example, consider that during the US military operation in Iraq and Afghanistan, private contractors amounted to about 50% of the total American presence. Let's think about the privatization of prison. So inmates held in private prison increased from zero to, I think, about 150,000 people from between the 1980s and 2000. And there was an increase of 56-57% more than between 2000 and 2013. When we look at social service provision, it's the same. Some states, 90% of social service provision is in the hands of private providers, whether for profit or no profit. But we can think about also the privatization of regulatory functions, the fact that governments outsource adjudicatory function to private arbitrators, or even the fact that they allow and sometimes even incentivize, right, the practice, for example, example, of private philanthropy as a substitute for the funding of essential goods, including primary and secondary education. So these are just all examples of privatization. But what I try to stress in the book is that privatization is not just about this or that particular delegation, but it's about the way in which all this transforms the administrative state itself. So there is a law scholar at Harvard, Jody Freeman, for example, that has argued that today the modern state is not really anymore close to the ideal Weberian administrative state, but it should be understood as a contracting state, where the state is just another horizontal contracting parties, you know, that secures certain goods. Or think about the way in which also the scholars have talked about the marketization of the bureaucracy. So the office holdings becomes almost indistinguishable from standard contract, contractual employment. So we can think about all these processes that are happening that really amounts to a process of state transformation and not just, you know, to that particular function being delegated to that particular agent.
Right, that's good. Yeah, so this is something that's becoming increasingly widespread, I assume, certainly in America, but also in other modern democracies. I don't know if you wanted to say briefly about, you know, your sense of the kind of historical development of this and trajectory of privatization. I mean, is that the idea? I'm assuming is that, you know, we had maybe a moment of Weberian bureaucracy, maybe not the, you know, the ideal form of it, but you know, a moment of a Weberian bureaucracy, and then, you know, sort of the much discussed neoliberal movements of the late 20th century were responsible for the privatization. I mean, is that, you might want to fill in that sketch, but is that the general idea here?
Yes, I think, I mean, historians actually disagree on this. I think some historians think that the rapture, or anyway, the discontinuity happens before, right after the Second World War and the expansion of the administrative state, and then a crisis of public trust that follow from that. But of course, a lot of emphasis has also been given to the 1970s, 1980s, so the moment of, you know, explosion of so-called what has by now been called neoliberalism as an ideology, and privatization is, it's almost a, I would say, a defining feature of neoliberalism. But we could think of privatization and not separately from neoliberalism, of course, also as a technique, right? It's a technocratic strategy through which also politicians can, at the same time, say, implement austerity, but at the same time give the impression that that government is still doing stuff, or to provide citizens with what they want, but without, but giving them at the same time the impression that government is not that big because it's hidden under the face of private actors. So there might be many different reasons, some more macro and some more micro, that explain, you know, why privatization has been so central in governance in the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. So that's interesting. I mean, interested in the sort of political strategies that politicians use to justify privatization. I mean, I suppose there's also sort of philosophical justification for privatization that, say, you know, libertarians point to as a cost-saving measure on the part of governments, a way to incentivize competition, you know, within the bureaucracy that would otherwise be, you know, stagnant and monolithic. I don't know if you want to speak to any of that. I mean, just as a kind of, you know, getting us started here with thinking about the motivation for the development of this.
Yes, exactly. So the idea is that, of course, privatization, we left the main political justification generally given is cost savings and improvement also of quality of services. The idea also that private actors can, you know, retain the gains of what they provide. And so that provides an incentives to win competitions, and the introduction of competitions make it the case that the quality of service will improve. The privatization is supposed to cut the cost of bureaucratic red tape and so be more efficient and cost effective. Often this is not something I think has been empirically confirmed, especially because initially calculation about the cost effectiveness of privatization failed to take into account all the costs that have to go into supervising and monitoring and to the maintenance of contracts. And these costs actually sometimes are so high that even if there is some efficiency gains, then they are in some sense outweighed by these other costs. But these are generally the sort of more economic justification given for privatization. And then, of course, philosophically, the very idea of privatization depends on an assumption that certain functions are public, because otherwise, conceptually speaking, privatization doesn't make sense. And that is what libertarians would in part deny. In the book, I say a little bit about how we should think about public functions in that sense.
Yeah, good. And I mean, there have been a number of critiques of privatization of government functions that have been out there in the scholarly world for a while. You talk about them in your first chapter. And I was wondering if you could maybe just discuss a couple of the ways that recent scholars have challenged the privatized state, and you find these approaches wanting or these critiques wanting, and maybe you could give us a sense of, you know, what the limitations are of those extant criticisms.
Sure. So let me first say that I think political philosophers have not given much attention to this topic, but I think there is a reason for that, actually. And the reason is that for liberal egalitarianism, which has been the dominant position in theories of justice and political philosophy in recent years, the central question is what government should fund as a matter of distributive justice. But to a large extent, how then what is funded ought to be provided or organized is just a matter of effectiveness and efficiency. So the question of the organization of provision is entirely derivative from the question of what better satisfy the principle of justice that are determined, you know, at a higher level. But I think this framework is, I think, reductive, first because it assumes that the nature of all goods or functions can be fixed or remain anyway unchanged independently of the agent who performs that function. But that's not necessarily the case. I mean, making an example that goes beyond, you know, maybe government functions, but think about the duty to apologize, right? If I outsource it, I might just conceptually defeat the very idea of an apology. And so I think it's important to question in the case of privatization whether we can just outsource to the private sector the delivery of certain function and the function will remain the same or not. Second, the outcomes-based approach of liberal egalitarianism and also of economists, I think in a different way, neglects question concerning legitimate standing, right? I can be the most effective actor, but I might just lack the appropriate standing or the sort of legitimacy necessary to perform a certain functions in a way that is not objectionable. But there have been, of course, many philosophers that have moved away from this sort of outcomes based framework, but generally this move has consisted in developing some form of an anti-commodification argument. So here the idea is that privatization reduces the meaning of certain social goods to mere commodities, and these forms of marketization is objectionable for a variety of reasons. So I'm thinking about, of course, from Michael Walzer, Elizabeth Anderson, Deborah Sass. And I think the anti-commodification argument has many advantages. But I think ultimately there are several problems with it. And to briefly mention two, one is that privatization need not entail necessarily marketization or at least a direct market exchange. So, you know, government can fund a good, can provide vouchers to people, and the source of market can be hidden behind. And so, and more importantly, I think that people can retain the capacity to value goods in a non-commodified way, even when these goods are provided through market strategies. So, you know, we buy Bibles in the market, but it doesn't mean that you value Bibles as mere commodities, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and because of this, another reason, instead, I wanted to move away from these sorts of approaches and instead think about privatization really as a question of legitimacy and try to show how privatization contradicts the very reasons why political institutions ought to exist in the first place. So that was, sort of where my criticism of this view brought me.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I like it, especially because it's, there are a lot of, we could say empirical critiques too of privatization, that it's, that it doesn't perform as well, or it's, it has a sort of market incentive that introduces into politics that might create, mixed motives and whatnot. And yeah, I mean, I think the signal approach of your book is to sort of suggest even if empirically they perform better, I mean, there's still a, underlying normative reason to be concerned here. So that's good. So let's turn to your approach, which is a Kantian approach. So I'm happy about that because I like Kant. So
I know you do.
Oh, good. So maybe you could say a little bit about, I mean, just to sort of get us started, thinking about the, I guess what you said a minute ago, where you sort of adumbrated this view that, political theorists tend to think that there is this independent end of justice, and that what our job as political theorists or political philosophers are to do is to think about the institutions and means as instruments to arrive at that sort of independent aim. You call this the interchangeable means to achieve the independently defined end of justice. Whereas the Kantian approach is quite different, which is to see, the institutions of government not as instruments towards an independent end of justice, but as sort of intrinsic to the provision of justice itself. So maybe you could say a little bit about what, your concern with that assumption and sketch broadly the Kantian view here.
Great. So so as I understand it, as you were saying a second ago, the interchangeability assumption, right, consists in the claim that at a fundamental level, justice can be both defined and fulfilled independently of the existence of any shared political institution. And so there the question of whether we would need a state or a system of public adjudication and enforcement of rights, or whether that could be done privately through other mechanisms, is just a question of, does the state help us to say solve coordination issue, or is a public system of adjudication more efficient or less efficient than a private one, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, I think this view is widespread. Like, we could think about libertarians like John Simmons. We could think about radical egalitarians like Jerry Cohen. We could think about institutional utilitarians like, say, Liam Murphy. Like, to hold more or less explicitly one or version of this view. So I thought that the strength of the Kantian position is precisely to show that this view is false, because political institutions are constitutive of justice. And that means that justice cannot be established independently of authoritative rules. And why? Well, I mean, this probably for many is familiar, but right, in the state of nature, that is, in the absence of authoritative political institution, no person can claim conclusive rights, because no person qua private person can have the authority to unilaterally legislate the condition of other person's freedom. And this means that no person can ultimately have the authority to unilaterally impose on others enforceable right, obligations that they would not otherwise have. And I think this is because, right, as private person, if we had the authority to determine according to our own private judgment, under what normative condition other people could act, then effectively their ability to act freely would be subject to our own merely unilateral will, and that this would be incompatible with their independence and with their freedom. But for Kantians, right analytically entails the ability to coerce, or the authority to coerce, and so the ability to impose enforceable obligation. And so analytically speaking, there cannot be rights in the state of nature. And if there cannot be rights, there cannot be justice. So the only solution really to this problem is to bring about authoritative rules and a unified system of authoritative rules that can serve to adjudicate and enforce rights without subjecting anyone to the merely unilateral will on another's. And it has to do so in a simultaneous and reciprocal way. And I think that, I mean, Kant of course thinks that the state, whether for him, he is more uncertain on whether it should be democratic or not and changes his mind. But I think that a democratic state is morally necessitated to fulfill this purpose. I just want to say for, we can go of course through them here, but since all this is familiar, the purpose of what I try to do in the book is, however, to rescue this view according to certain objection, especially from Lockeans and others that have tried to argue that this view cannot hold. And I also want to say that, however, of course, even if you agree with Kantians that the state is morally necessitated to adjudicate and enforce rights, you can still, of course, hold the view that governance should be entirely privatized. So the purpose of the book is simply to show how, however, instead, a system of privatized governance ultimately undermines the very same reasons that make the state morally necessitate. And that's something that, you know, if you're a Kantian, you don't need necessarily to agree with. That requires further steps in the argument.
Right, because if I'm understanding you right, a Kantian view leads you to the assumption that the legislative functions, that is the legislation of right, has to be omnilateral in Kant's language, that is issuing from a general will. But the execution of that, of right need not issue from an omnilateral will, maybe, or at least it requires further argumentation. And so that's what you do in the book, which is great. So, but just sort of to further underline this point, because this is great. Maybe you could clarify Kant's view just from this other perspective, because one of the strange things about Kant, I've often thought, is that there's a kind of asymmetry in his practical philosophy, you can say, between his moral philosophy and his political philosophy, which is, you know, in the state of nature, of course, for Kant, moral disagreement can be resolved, right? If in the state of nature, you know, one disagrees about a moral topic, there can be a conclusive resolution based on the categorical imperative, right? Because the moral law is universally applicable everywhere. However, here's this weird thing that for Kant, in the state of nature, the provision of right, the rules of right, are not conclusive or determinate. That is, disagreements about what is justice actually cannot be resolved. I mean, Kant is a kind of Hobbesian here. He says in the doctrine of right, it just is sort of, there is no right, there is no justice in the state of nature. So maybe say a little bit about why is that? What accounts for this asymmetry?
I mean, that's a very difficult question. And I'll try, you know, to sort of guess some answers. Of course, not a question actually I directly address in the book, but I think here both the notion of right and of the authority to coerce that is intrinsic to right are crucial, I think, to explain some of the difference between disagreement about ethics and disagreement about rights. Because seems to me when it comes to Kant's ethical sphere, right, the question is how we ought to act. And the categorical imperative tells each of us that we ought to act upon a maxis that can also hold as a universal law. But in this case, it seems that the fact that a maxim could be something that, say, everyone could rationally will to act on may be sufficient to make my acting on the maxim morally permissible, because it is sufficient to make my acting in this way compatible with respecting everyone else's inner freedom or ability to autonomously self-legislate. But I think things are different in the juridical case, because in this case, the question is not how we should act, but rather, right, who's authorized to coerce others into rightful behavior. And in this case, it seems to me that, like, the fact that a particular determination could be rationally willed by all, but actually is not, and there may be multiple other valid and equally reasonable determination, make it insufficient to justify our authority to coerce, because the coerced person could always reasonably refuse to be coerced in their way. And so here is where I think that the structural indeterminacy of right is crucial, right? And also allows us to explain why we cannot refuse to be coerced out of the state of nature, because exiting the state of nature is a practically necessary means to achieve equal freedom, so to say. But we can always refuse to be coerced to accept a certain determinations, even if correct and valid, because there may be others valid determination. And so even if there was a sort of empirical agreement or epistemic agreement on a certain determination, we would still have reasons to refuse the coercion. And then finally, I mean, I also wonder, this is more speculative, but whether the kind of agreement we need in the moral and the juridical sphere is different, because it seems to me that rights cannot conflict. Like, you cannot have the right to eat this orange if I have the right to eat this orange. But you could be morally permitted to eat this orange, and I could be morally permitted to this orange, even if only one of us can eat this orange. And also our actions, if we, decide to give a gift or something like that, change constantly our rights and how they are distributed. So it seems that the agreement required on determining the content of rights requires a certain kind of uniformity, reciprocity, precision, and coordination that maybe moral agreement does not necessarily require. But as I said, I mean, I would have to think more about all this, but very interesting question.
No, that's good. That's good. It's more for my edification, but I could also see a kind of Lockean coming at it for this angle, because it strikes me, the Lockean view almost sort of is a, attempt to bring together this sort of moral philosophical approach and juridical approach. But yeah, I mean, it strikes me that, Kant is very aware that these two different things are asymmetrical and giving an account of almost two different accounts of freedom, right? Because we're talking in the moral case about internal freedom, whereas in the political case, we're talking about external freedom. That is the way in which our essentially our bodies conflict with one another in space, which is not the case in the moral philosophy. I just have one more question about Kant. So you're indulging me here, but this is relevant also to your argument, which is about the state of nature. And, so you follow Kant in arguing that, there are no rules of rights in the state of nature, or they're not legitimate in any case. Though Kant also has a view that there are forms of provisional right in the state of nature that are only made conclusive in civil society. So we can have possession of things, but we can't have actually property until they're sanctioned by an omnilateral will. So I actually was just thinking about this in the context of your work, like about privatization. I mean, in if you had any thoughts about how this category of provisionality about right could maybe fit in, and if it's possible for, you know, someone, a defender of the privatization of state functions, to say, well, maybe this is provisionally rightful. Maybe it's not illegitimate in the way that you want to argue, but maybe it's provisionally right. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so maybe I don't know if, I know that there are different views about provisionality, but I have a view where provisional rights are still not rights. I mean, they are not just rights that we have holding on a temporary or exceptional basis, say. But they're not rights in the sense that they express the idea of provisionality, as I understand it, express a contradiction that is internal to freedom and that it is not solved or solvable in the state of nature. So freedom requires that we appropriate objects, for example, and that we acquire certain rights, but it also prohibits us from imposing binding obligation on others, and so makes the acquisition of those rights impossible. And this contradiction is partially mitigated in the state of nature because there is a postulate of practical reasons regarding rights that gives us a permissive, a sort of authorization to have, for example, property, and that gives us some authorization to protect our properties against external attempt to take it. But that authorization seems to be only conditional on the fact that we can coerce others only when this is required by the end of exiting the state of nature, right? So it's not that, it's conditional on achieving or moving toward the end of a rightful condition. And at the same time, I think the idea of provisionality also entails that actually others never acquire full obligation to really respect our property as such. So in this sense, I don't think that provisional rights are truly rights. And so to say, even if we were to say the privatization is provisionally rights, would be to say not that it's transitionally just, but rather that it's devoid of justice in some sense and is still illegitimate. And so we still have a duty to exit, right? To exit it, to move beyond it. So, yeah, I mean, and as I do in the book, that would be compatible with saying that for the time being, maybe private actors may have, you know, the right to do certain things. They may have even the duties to do certain things within the privatized state, but the sort of rights should be exercised in a way that eliminate their condition of possibility, that actually we should move toward an exit from privatization in the same way which we should exit the provisional state of the state of nature.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. So you, apologies to those who are not interested in Kantian weeds as I am here on this, but I, you know, so let me ask you to sort of apply the Kantian theory to, you know, concrete case. You use the case of private arbitration in the United States, and I thought maybe you could speak to that and why you think it, you know, fails on legitimacy grounds in Kant. And I love this case because it's, you know, I remember, you know, buying a car a couple of years ago, and the, you know, the Honda dealership, you know, you have to sign a contract for the Honda dealership says, right, if there's disagreements, then I, you know, I agree to consult with private arbitration in order to resolve disagreements, right? And this made news years ago, and you know, you give it a nice treatment here. I wonder if you could say a little about it.
Yeah, sure. Maybe briefly. So, well, first of all, to sketch a little bit what private arbitration is. So in recent years, right, judges have increasingly outsourced their adjudicatory functions to private actors like private arbitrators, which are really empowered ultimately to decide on the rights and duties and remedies, right, for wrongs in relation to corporation, employees, and customers. So, importantly, arbitration in the US is now often mandatory, which means that, for example, employers and customers of private firms do not have the option often to go to court. Rather, they are obliged to rely on private arbitration, for example, for claims of sex and age discrimination or negligent treatment and so on and so forth. And importantly, both employers and customers acquire obligation to arbitrate, yes, by signing contracts. So one could say, well, that there is the omnilateral authorization through contract laws. But often these contracts, they don't have alternatives to signing of these contracts, and these contracts are not even voluntarily negotiated. They're just prepared often by the most powerful parties, generally corporations. But still, one could say on its face, private arbitration seems to present no problem of legitimacy, right? Because the delegation of adjudicatory power to the arbitrator is publicly sanctioned by an omnilateral will, and arbitrators are supposed to be neutral and act impartially. But there are several problems that I try to highlight in the books. First is that the delegation of adjudicatory function to private actors, I think the delegation itself should often be regarded as invalid and so as lacking authorizing force, because private arbitration compromises the ability of the state to secure an effective and reciprocal system of equal rights. And so it's incompatible with the end of the omnilateral will, which is to secure an equal system of rights. And I think this is often the case because a system of private arbitration makes it the case that the same kind of right violation, for example, by identically positioned individuals within the same jurisdiction, can lead to the adjudication of very, very different remedies on the basis of different privately chosen procedures or different contractual agreements, rather than on the basis of a public interpretation of the law. So if remedies then are ways in which people's rights are in part vindicated, then it seems that a system of this kind really fails to equally vindicate the status of all as rights bearers, because effectively makes remedies and so our standing as rights claimants dependent on privately stipulated rules are applied not in a systematic and equal and reciprocal way. And then there is another important fact, I think, that even if we assume the validity of authorizations, right, judges are holders of a public office and they operate within a clear set of constitutionally mandated procedures. So you may think that when a citizen comply with the judge's judgment, they ipso facto can think of themselves as being dependent on an omnilateral will. But the situation with the arbitration is different because arbitrators are not offices of the state. They're simply private, they're private agents that the only purpose of their main allegiance is to interpret the will of the contracting parties. And so in that sense, they do not operate within constitutionally mandated procedures, and also often defer entirely to the agreements that are written and sanctioned by private corporations themselves. And so a system of private arbitration also in this case leaves citizens dependent on a particular will, the will expressed in these contractual agreements, rather than right on the legal process as a whole. And that's another way why we may think that private arbitration generates this problem of subjection to the particular will of others in the adjudication of rights that we saw in the state of nature.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so at this point in the book, you proceed, I think, in the following way. Let me sort of run this by you and see if I have you correct. The way you proceed is essentially by pointing out how modern bureaucracies work and the potential challenge that even modern bureaucracies opposed to Kantian equal independence and a kind of legitimacy crisis in themselves. That is, you know, with the growth in the modern administrative state, you know, you see, like, for example, the U.S. Congress, right, delegates to any number of administrative agencies regulatory power. It's essentially a kind of legislative power in the executive branch itself. I mean, we're familiar nowadays with like the CDC and the FDA. I mean, these are sort of quasi sort of legislative and executive units. And so, you know, part of the idea here, what I gather from your argument is that these bureaucracies pose a kind of challenge in themselves or a potential threat to the equal independence of citizens because they're not clearly ratified by an omnilateral will. They don't come from the legislature. They come from sort of unaccountable bureaucrats, as it were, in the bureaucracy. However, and this is the big however, the way you proceed is that that kind of threat that modern bureaucracies pose can be mitigated through a couple measures, which I want to talk about, three different measures that you discuss, so that we can kind of salvage like modern administrative state, but the privatization of the modern bureaucratic state makes that mitigation impossible. Do I have that right? That's kind of complicated. So I just wanted to make sure I have that roughly right.
Yeah. So first, there is a theory, right, of what are the conditions of legitimate administrative exercise, the legitimate exercise of administrative discretion. And then those conditions are meant to be essential to solve the problem of bureaucratic unilateralism. That would be the problem of the state of nature reproduced within the state itself by the bureaucracies. And those conditions, I think, can be met within the bureaucracies, but then they're not met by private actors. And that's why the problem of unilateralism it's instead reproduces unavoidably within a privatized state. So briefly, well, you know, on the standard view of bureaucracy, as soon as you have valid authorization, the bureaucrats can be removed, acts within the mandate, that's it, that's legitimate. But as you were saying, the problem is that in these new modern administrative states, not only as also, for example, Henry Richardson in his book, as well argued and demonstrated, right, the bureaucrats ends up revising the ends of policy. And so the appeal to the ends of policies cannot be sufficient to legitimize their exercise of discretion because it's these very ends that get revised. And in part because also, as you were mentioning, right, there is an increased blurring between the administrative and legislative power in this kind of large modern administrative states. So the view I defend is that we need thicker demands of legitimacy than the one put forward by the standard view. And one demand, which is the most important demand, perhaps, is the fact that if really the exercise of legislative and administrative powers blurs, then some of the demands of democratic legitimacy that apply to political activity should at least partly be extended to administrative activity. So most obviously, legislative power must always be exercised in a representative capacity. That is to say, in the name of the citizens, here understood as a collective body. And therefore, administrative discretion can be legitimate, not only if it meets, and this is the first condition, a condition of valid authorization. That is, the delegation must be validly authorized in a way that, you know, respects certain procedures. And there must be, of course, certain kinds of top-down control to make sure that the bureaucrats, you know, exercise a certain kind of fidelity toward the legislator. But it's also important that the bureaucrats themselves, while exercising their discretion and their quasi-legislative power, exercise that power in a genuinely representative capacity. And in one chapter of the book, I try to explain what that means. And finally, beyond an authorization and a representation condition, the exercise of the administrative power, I think, can only be legitimate, right, if it succeeds in specifying the law in a way that, as we said, both falls within the boundaries of the authorized mandate, but at the same time contributes to rearticulate the mandate in a way that can itself be regarded as an expression of the public will. And without going into much details, what I think this requires is that the administrative process itself must be partly democratized. Not only you need input from below, but you need that through certain participatory mechanism, but you also need a certain system of co-determination where basically civil servant and people decide together how, you know, what it means for administrative regulations to be compatible with the shared will of the people. So to, you know, recapitulate it, there is an authorization condition, a representation condition, and then a condition of appropriate domain or appropriate scope for the legitimacy of.
Right, that's good. I mean, in part, your book, right, your book is also a sort of, it's a robust sort of defense of, as you say, a sort of democratization of the administrative state, right? So it's not just a critique of privatization. The critique of privatization makes that the democratization of administrative state even more impossible than it already is. But it's also, you know, it points towards a high ideal of, you know, so for example, I mean, it just occurred to me, I mean, what would you think about electing like a national election for the head of the FDA and the CDC? Would that be what you would have in mind, something like that?
Well, no, because so the model of bureaucracy I defend falls in some sense between two extreme poles. No? That then maybe in the history of political thought, we can think about, I don't know, Hegel and Kant on the one end, the universal class of bureaucrats, independent, they can better understand you know, the needs of society because of this sort of viewpoint that is detached. And on the other end, you know, Marx and Rousseau, who were very skeptical about mediating figures. And the view I want to defend that falls in the middle, in the sense that I think the bureaucracy should be democratized because in part of not only a problem with how to legitimize residual administrative discretion, but also in part because I think the idea of expertise of the bureaucrat need to be understood broadly, and it requires knowledge of social experiences of different kinds. So the bureaucracy itself need to become more descriptively representative. And also because a democratization of the bureaucracy through participatory mechanism would help also rebuild trust in some sense and limiting its alienating aspects. But I don't want to go all the way down with the election of all figures, you know, I mean, it's because I still believe that a certain kind of insulation of the bureaucracy, partial insulation of the bureaucracy, certain kind of independence of tenure protection of, you know, the conditions that make for, that differentiate the bureaucrats from the elected official. And there is a reason for why that should be the case. A bureaucrat, unlike the elected officials, it's as two bosses. One is the democratic state and the other are the people. But the democratic state, including being filled to the rule of law, to, you know, certain rule of non-arbitrariness, et cetera, requires certain, that the bureaucrat has a certain feature and is protected and partly insulated in certain ways, in a way that it's not the case for elected officials. So this is just to say that there are, I think, reasons to, not of mere compromise, but actually normative reasons to hold that middle view between those two models I was talking about earlier, where we do not want to entirely democratize the bureaucracy, but to do so in important ways.
Right. Yeah, this is a big question. Where does the general will lie? Does it lie in the democratic government, or does it lie in the people? So I see. This is a tension. This is a problem. Good. Okay. So that's helpful. Let me ask you about these three different features of what should we call it? Sort of an ideal bureaucracy that is one that's authorized by an omnilateral will, one that represents an omnilateral will, and one that's sort of delegated by the omnilateral will. And particularly, this is the way you proceed in this part of the book is to talk about how, you know, when bureaucracy privatizes its activity, it fails to meet these conditions. So to start with the problem of authorization, right? The question here is whether private entities can be authorized by the omnilateral will to wield legitimate power. Can government delegate its role to private entities? Would these be permissible by the general will? And you argue that the omnilateral will can't authorize a private entity to carry out its will. So can you develop as to why that is?
So this chapter has more of an aggregative argument. So I'm not saying that the omnilateral will blocks any authorization of any private actor at all times, but there is a question of aggregation in a way that explained. So here, this chapter building on also and helping myself with recent literature in the social science, right? I argue that the extensive delegation of public functions to private organization distinctively undermines certain material and effective minimal preconditions of democratic self-rule. So first, it undermines government's directive control over its agents. And this is because I think the reasons that make privatization initially appealing and prima facie justified, we were talking about earlier, so cost saving, or also the lack of institutional capacity on behalf of the public bureaucracy. These reasons that push toward privatization are the very same reasons or features that prevent government from then being able to effectively maintain the capacity to supervise their delegates. So this is a commonly studied phenomenon. The more a government privatizes, the more it has to privatize. And the more it privatizes, the more it loses control over its own agents. So there is here a big problem of directive control. Second, I think privatization distinctively undermines civic vigilance because it makes the role of government largely invisible to its citizens, often leading citizens to think that it's the market, philanthropy, or voluntarism that take care of their needs. This was, if you remember, during the Obama's healthcare campaign, where people were saying, you know, put your hands off my Medicaid, like if they didn't know there was a governmental program. But they have a point, because often they receive all these goods, right, through also private actors. And I think if people don't see government as the agent that provides for them, then they see themselves as having no reason to care about political institutions. So here there is also a question of affective attachment and of civic vigilance. And third, I think when privatization, even when it does not generate plain corruption, that it often does, still it upsets the distribution of political influence and opportunities for political influence in societies. And in part, this is due to the fact that it gives private actors an extra incentive to pressure governments to make certain policies that will renew contracts. And also private actors, unlike public actors, have the ability to just discretionary manage their own property, right? Their discretionary resources, that they can use to press government. And the more a government becomes dependent of private actors, the more also it becomes, to some extent, enslaved to their requests. And so in these different ways, private actors can exercise, you know, a kind of influence that no other citizens could possibly exercise. So what's the point of all this? Well, if it is true that privatization distinctively undermines the minimal precondition of democratic self-rule, if it is true that a government, an unilateral will, cannot give up on democracy. So democratic self-rule is not something that can be abdicated or alienated, then at least past a certain threshold, privatization contract should be regarded as lacking authorizing force. And so the result is that the private actors who exercise political power, quasi-legislative power under those contracts, do so in a way that is unauthorized. And so they do so in a way that reproduces, right, the problem of the state of nature within the state itself. They do so unilaterally.
That's good. I was wondering, though, you know, in this case, I mean, in the way in which even in America, the, as you say, when people say keep your government hands off my Medicare, I mean, what, they're already pointing out that, you know, executive bureaucratic services are sort of invisible to them. There's a, you know, general worry about, you know, bureaucratic non-responsiveness. I guess here's what I'm thinking. Would you be happy if we bolstered the democracy, the sort of legislative branch to amp up democracy in America and gave that legislative branch more control over the executive bureaucracy, but privatized all of it, right? So that legislators would, you know, have oversight over the government contracts and whatnot. So, you know, the people would be in charge, but they would just be in charge of, you know, evaluating the contractual bids for various contractors. So I'm assuming you wouldn't like that.
Well, I think answering just your question, thinking about what of these three problems, for example, that I highlight about democratic self-rule would that solve? I mean, that might solve a little bit the problem of directive control. Although again, here I want to say, because it's true that one could say, well, look, that problem is also with bureaucracy. It's nothing to do with public and private, right? The legislator also loses directive controls of bureaucratic agents. But I think it's different. There is something in the logic of privatization that makes that problem distinctively worse, and is the fact that, right, the reason to delegate in the first place is because the legislator is meant to lack certain kind of knowledge or certain lack of expertise. So the delegations have their own reason. In the case of privatization, right, it's cost effectiveness, it's compensated for lack of capacity. And so in a certain way, then solving the problem by just giving all the control to the legislator seems to be self-defeating in some sense. And I doubt that these forms of top-down control could anyway solve the entire problem of, you know. But even if that was the case, it seems to me that the problem of affective attachment to political institution as a symbolic component, right? I don't know, I grew up in Italy. I always, you know, went to public school. I always say my school for me was like a post office, right? There is no, it's not an association with its own private identity. It's just it's just a service of the state that is provided to you. And I don't want to, I mean, Italy has many problems, so I would not, but there was something very important in the way in which I think growing up, right, in a country where you always, the state is the first referent for the sort of services that you obtain, whether that be education or healthcare, that shapes your attachment to political institutions and also your ability to trust them. And so I wonder whether this sort of more effective problems will be solved, right, by simply increasing the legislator control.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think in I can't speak for everyone in the Anglo-American world, but you know, certainly the TV show Yes Minister. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it's a British show from, in, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago. But I'm not sure if that encapsulates the sort of Anglo-American distrust of the very thing that you were saying, right? They had, you know, these were sort of the unelected bureaucrats who would just say Yes Minister to, right, when the minister comes along, and then, you know, do absolutely nothing in order to keep their job and, you know, and go about their business. And, yeah. you know, I mean, this was a show that came out in the, I think, in the time where sort of the, these neoliberal reforms were afoot. But I trust he can see the point, right? Which is that, you know, yes, you know, there might be problems with legitimacy in terms of privatization, but at least what we can get in terms of privatization is to incentivize those executive agents to actually act for the public will as opposed to obstructed. I don't know what you think of that.
Well, first of all, incentives, it seems to me they're they're never robust in the sense self-interest incentives last until they last. And then when that's your only motives to act, then, you know, the commitment that the motive can support becomes very unstable. Also, I wonder whether that's, again, here, perhaps you may think more the worry of someone, you know, of philosophers rather than people, but there is something about reducing the question of bureaucracy to a question of incentives to act in certain ways seems to me to neglect or to focus on simply if they don't act that way, we can always kick them out and remove them. It seems to me to put all the accent on ex post form of accountability, but I think as citizens, we have the right to have those who exercise important forms of power over us, whether it be the developing of categorization according to which welfare services are provided, or you know, forms of powers that the bureaucracy exercise every day. We have a right to have that form of power to exercise in the moment in which it is exercised, in a way that is publicly representative, and it represents a public form of judgment rather than a private one. And the system of incentives, I think, misses these important forms of accountability, let's say, in the present, rather than ex post. Now, I give you some incentives. If they last, they last. If not, I can ex post remove you. But I think that exactly misses something important about the fact that as a citizen, I need not to be subject to an arbitrary form of power right now, not when is the moment for me to exercise my power of removal.
Right. That makes good sense. I mean, it underscores, I think, how your own view is distinct from, I guess, what I would associate with a sort of economic view about public choice theory, principal agents approaches to bureaucratic approaches, where you sort of align the self-interest in the right way, you have a sort of Kantian Hegelian, maybe you can bring in the Hegel side of your view here, which is that, you know, the idea that government agents have to have a particular kind of ethos, that is, there must be a sort of internalization of the representation of the omnilateral will, that it can't just be a bunch of vectors of self-interest that somehow aggregate into the public will, but that there's some kind of ethos that needs to be embedded within these officials. So maybe you could say a little bit about that ethos and how it plays into your view of representation.
Great. Yes. So maybe I should start with the idea of representation, because the ethos comes from there, right? So in one chapter of the book, I really address the question, what it means to represent, in the sense, what it means to act as speak in the name of another. And the question is asked because, again, one of the conditions for the legitimate exercise of administrative power was this idea that it has to be exercised in a representative capacity. And here I first object to what I think is a fairly dominant view that says that, if someone has authorized you to act as their representative and you act within the boundaries of the mandate, then you are a successful representative. And this is, I call the externalist view, because here representation is just a question of the external conduct of the office holder complying with the requirements of the mandate. And I think Kantians, like, for example, Arthur Ripstein as well, hold this sort of view. But I find this view, even if I see how it's the most logical Kantian view, I see it as missing something. And to see why, let me consider the example of a spy, right? A spy, say, of a Russian spy, wants to infiltrate in the American government and he doesn't want to be discovered. So the spy complies with the content of her given mandate and does so intentionally, does her job very well. No one could ever realize that she's a spy. Has she acted in the name of the American citizens? Well, I would say no, the spy hasn't acted. If the citizens could realize, they would have reasons to disavow the spy's action as not done in their name. And so the question is, why hasn't the spy, right? And one possible explanation, which I provide in the chapter, is that the spy, right, acts externally according to the demands of her mandate. But she does so for reasons that is on the basis of considerations, serving the interests of a foreign government in this case, that has excluded reasons in the sense that the mandate that she has, or occupying a governmental position within the American government, just is the reasons for why other reasons, in this case, you know, serving the interests of a foreign government, just are excluded as valid reason for actions from given the role that she occupies. And so on this basis, I argue that right, representation should be understood as a successful representative is not someone always that comply with the mandate externally, but that acts for appropriate kind of reasons that are not excluded by the role that occupies. But at this point, one objection, of course, is this is completely incompatible with a Kantian account, because it would seem that now we are back to having citizens dependent on the office holder's good intention, goodwill, mental states. And that was all the entire problem of the state of nature was that problem, right? But I think here the ethos, the bureaucratic ethos, provides a solution to this problem in the sense that the bureaucrat's appropriate intentional orientation and appropriate deliberative capacity, so to say, depend on the way that the civil service is socialized to internalize a public ethos. And the ethos, the bureaucratic ethos, is, and here is the Hegelian element, is a feature of institutions. It's not a feature of the simple mental psychological state of the office holder. So when the citizens are dependent on the office holder's appropriate, you know, deliberative orientations, they're not dependent on the office holder's private will or mental state, but they're dependent on the institutions that create and sustain this bureaucratic ethos. And that's, of course, why I also defend a model of bureaucracy that must retain a certain kind of special education for the civil service, a special kind of long-term socialization and, you know, on the French model, we might say, but more democratic, perhaps, than the French model.
Yeah, that's great. I love the idea of a sort of civil service kind of education. I'm looking at the clock. Time's running short. I wanted to ask you about some of the applications, some of the examples that you use. And in particular, you have a chapter that's devoted to private donors, which is very provocative, I would say. Because in discussing private donors, you talk about the sort of duties of private donors in this chapter and fold you know, the tendency in America and elsewhere towards a reliance on donors in terms of this privatization account that you're giving, and you see the reliance on private donors as a way of kind of violating the Kantian norms that you've been talking about. And you talk. I mean, one of the most provocative things I think you argue is that we should think about private donors giving less in terms of virtues of beneficence, supererogatory duties, something like that, but rather in terms of reparative justice, right? That is, that the donors should conceive of their activities in terms of repairing past injustices from their games. So maybe you could say a little bit about why you see private donors as falling within this this account of the privatized state that you've been talking about, and maybe justify that very provocative claim that I just suggested.
So yes, I think that in a context where basically the state fails to provide for the poor, right? Even the, sometimes fairly basic material resources, and leaves part of this task, for example, to philanthropy, then we cannot understand within this context what the wealthy has in their pocket has been entirely their own. And the reason is that this system compromises, we may say, the very rationale avoiding due dependence that arguably makes a system of property rights justified in the first place. So within this condition of injustice, the wealthy, I think, cannot claim full property rights. But this fact is not just a mere coincidence. The fact that we find ourselves in this situation, it is partly the responsibility, or at least we may say the liability, of the wealthy themselves, either because some of them might have directly contributed to the injustice, or because by benefiting from it sometimes perpetrates it, or simply because they have a duty to restore rightful relationship and they might not do enough to do that. These facts jointly taken, I think, makes it the case that in non-ideal conditions, we should regard the duty to give, right, as a matter of reparative justice, or giving to others what is rightfully their own, rather than giving resources that we rightfully own and spending them on a discretionary basis. Now, one might ask why there is a duty of philanthropy in the first place. Well, because I think on the one end, right, so how the freedom of the poor, and if you think about certain cases like, say, children need education right now, they can't wait for the state to increase taxation or for a public institutions of a just kind to be restored. So the freedom of the poor, we may say, provide us reason for thinking that philanthropy is the only way to limit the damage in existing condition of unjust institutions. And so it provides us reasons to ground a duty to give. But on the same time, that's the very same freedom, see philanthropy as an immoral means to do that, we may say, because philanthropy creates precisely that undue dependence between the philanthropist and the recipient that we should overcome through institution in the first place. And this is why I think the duty to give should be regarded as provisional, in the sense that it's kind of required but condemned morally at the same time. So it has this internal contradiction. And I think an important implication, perhaps not completely obvious of this view, is that if really we should think about giving as reparation, then we should not think that the beneficiaries have a right to determine the direction of giving. Because I think creditors don't get to determine, according to their own preferences, the way debts should be repaid. The way debts should be repaid is determined by external standards. It's not determined by the creditors' preferences. But at the same time, I think philanthropy ought to be democratized, and so beneficiaries should have a voice, because not only they have better information about the nature of the injustice, perhaps, but also because giving them a voice and perhaps also control over direction of giving, hence the veto power of beneficiaries, I propose, within decision-making within philanthropic foundations, these kind of controls may at least mitigate the undue dependency that philanthropy creates. And so there are reasons to democratize philanthropy that are not, however, do not derive from the fact that there is, a right of the beneficiary to shape giving according to their own preferences.
Right. So, yeah, my wife is a fundraiser, so she works with some of these organizations a lot. So, yeah. So is the idea something? Yeah, right. I think you just alluded to it a minute ago that, take large philanthropic organizations. I think you mentioned Bill Gates. I mean, the Gates Foundation, for example. So the idea on your view would be something like the Gates Foundation, just like a nonprofit corporation, ought to have representatives on its board from, I guess, the community. What is it? The community, or the poor, or some sort of otherwise disadvantaged group? Is that the suggestion?
Yes, or if not directly the beneficiary, grassroots organization that and that they should have a veto power, in the sense that they should exactly veto, should have the right to veto donations or discretionary spending of funds that the community understands as potentially harmful or pernicious or for whatever reason they do not they think as problematic. And of course, this is the extreme kind of control, but more importantly, there should be public hearings, so to say, with this. So they, because it's maybe there is, who would reject this kind of giving. So the most important fact is that they play an advisory role about how to direct this kind of givings and what kind of needs, what kind of issues should be prioritized in which ways.
Right. But on the matter of justice, presumably your view, it sounds a little bit like Kant's again, that Kant has a view that if there are the desperately poor or whatever in society, the rich have a juridical obligation to contribute to the state. Again, Kant, as you adumbrated a minute ago, has huge problems with philanthropy as a solution to that, and so instead advocates a kind of redistribution through through taxation. But presumably, so your idea would be, if the populace attains a certain sort of minimal standard of living, then these democratic constraints would be released, or no, on your view?
Yes, I mean, there could be other reasons that we may think, it's always good to reduce dependency. It's always good to, epistemically speaking, have more information than less if you make a decision about where to give. So I think there will be reasons, but I think maybe we wouldn't talk about duties or requirements of a certain kind within an ideal society, right? Because you might think if the state really provides in securing, determinate material conditions, then maybe the question of the incompatibility between philanthropy and freedom would no longer be there. Philanthropy in that society then might just play, for example, a more discretionary role. It could just be regarded as a means to fund non-essential kind of goods, et cetera, et cetera. So, there could be reasons to democratize philanthropy even in these more ideal conditions, but they would not be of the same kind of pressing kind than in a situation like this. And by the way, yes, of course, I mean, this is the argument here. We are at the stage of the book of provisionalis, that we are within the privatized state. That's not the ideal. The ideal is to exit the privatized state. But within the privatized state, the assumption is that a right taxation scheme does not exist and is not going to exist anytime soon. The state is privatized, and so that's why these other requirements kick in.
Yeah, good. And I wanted to ask you on the side of organizations rather than donors, private providers, as it were, in your next chapter. I'm interested in the case of the privatization of education, which I think is an example maybe you don't raise. Maybe I'm misremembering, but in any case, so maybe this is an unfair question, but I wonder what your take on it is, which is, and what I'm thinking here is like sort of like charter schools and so forth, which is, publicly funded schooling that nevertheless has a sort of privatized like mandate, organization, decision structure, et cetera, et cetera. Which, on some views, even some views on the left, there's a sort of recognition that one of the benefits of this, again, increases competition, increases the amount of diversity that's offered. What's your take? What do you think in the sort of provisional state, what the duties of, privatized educational organizations would be?
Yeah, so I mean, you're right that actually in the book I don't address fully the question of education, but because I think it's a very complex case, and so let me tell you how I think about it in a couple of ways. So first of all, there is, I think, an interesting question, which is whether civic education, which I think is part, it's a fundamental part of any compulsory education program, whether civic education is a inherently communicative good. And by this, I mean, that people have talked about punishment as communicative good in the sense of punishment. In the sense that when we educate children, a society does many things, but one of it, it's also that it sends messages, I think, of approval and disapproval about certain social expectation. And in this way, children learn, right? What it means to be a good citizen or bad citizens. And when they don't submit their essay on time, maybe the way the teacher disapproval that is not her personal disapproval, but the fact that she communicates also the disapproval that say a certain kind of expectation hasn't been met. And in this way, I think children learn also how to be in society, how to be citizens, what the public expectation are. So if you think that there is a communicative public component in education, then I think it's important that the form of communication is done in the name of society as a whole. And we goes back to this question of representation. Can a private schools with their own private goals really, communicate this message in the name of the public? And I think many of the issues that I mentioned with the problem of private actors that they, or maybe I didn't mention, but the idea is that private actors have a difficult time meeting the representation condition because they have comprehensive goals. And so they always tend to act for reasons that ought to be regarded as excluded reason for action from the perspective of a government role. And I think this problem also applies to school. But at the same time, I think the schooling is a special case, especially in cases, where justice itself, I think in many contexts may require school to act instead on the basis of their non-public goals. And here, of course, I'm thinking about cases as they may exist in many societies of multicultural, multi-religion societies, right? Where the state has, for example, a history of marginalization or oppression with some of the groups. And in this case, I think securing a pluralistic educational system becomes itself a requirement of justice. And so the fact that the schools act according to their own private views to some extent, right, it's something that might itself be justified in the name of pluralism and ultimately in the name of justice. So the school, just to say that the schooling case is very complex, But in the so in the non in the privatized state, assuming that there is a problem with private schools, what the school I think also should do should be partly internally democratized, not only be subject to certain top-down control from above and making sure that the policies they adopt, the curricula they adopt aligns with constitutional essentials, that they are discussed in light of public reasons, not private reason, et cetera, et cetera. But also that beneficiary, and by beneficiary, I don't mean only the parents, but also part of the broader citizenship, because schooling is a broader thing than just a relationship between parents and students, can be included in part of these decisions within the school themselves.
That's great. That's a great answer. And I really have enjoyed this conversation, Chiara. This has been really great. And you know, thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.